Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute Productions. Last year, we started something called the Decade Project, where we look back 10 years on the movies that really continue to resonate and hang around. And we've continued it into this year. But I had to cheat because this movie, I couldn't wait another year. It's only 9 years old. But last year, you may remember we had one of my favorite conversations that's ever happened on One Heat Minute Productions, a huge behemoth conversation about the sensational Blue Room with its director and writer, Jeremy Saulnier, and the star, Macon Blair, and my legendary friend, Roxana Haddadi. And we have been talking about coming back, going, let's talk about the next film in their series together and the next film that Jeremy made, Green Room. Let's talk about it. But I could not wait until 2025 to say actually that this is an episode of the Decade Project. So it's not. It is just Roxana Haddadi and I pestering the great Jeremy Saulnier and Macon Blair to rejoin us to have a conversation about a movie that is so harrowing and so fucking awesome that it is just impossible for us not to have this conversation. And what is perfect right now is that earlier this week, from the UK, my special edition 4K second sight Blu-ray of Green Room arrived in my hot little hands, and I've been so excited to talk to these guys about it. Roxana, welcome. Jeremy, welcome.
Thank you.
And our main Oppenheimer, Macon Blair, welcome back to One Heat Minute Productions. Guys, it's so great to see all your faces on my screen right now as we record this. Thank you so much for coming back and talking to us about this sensational movie that, you know, Roxana and I have a really special relationship with.
Our pleasure.
Very happy to be here.
We rejected time. I like that we rejected time to make this happen.
Ignore
Big
time.
Big fan of that.
Who cares? I want to talk about this movie.
I don't care.
Let's make it happen.
Yeah.
So firstly, Second Sight coming to you guys and putting a fantastic release together, Jeremy, Macon. Did you like, was that a lovely surprise that they were like, okay, this is one that we want to like turn our attention to? Because if you don't know, Second Sight is a fantastic imprint. That's an international imprint. They do great stuff. They've, you know, they're one of those people who did a sensational Peter Weir movie, one of my favorites, Picnic at Hanging Rock. They did a version of Picnic at Hanging Rock, and you may have already owned it on the Criterion Collection. You may have already owned it on Umbrella, but you're then a psycho like me who has to go, I kind of have to need that one. I need the essays. I need the commentaries. And so I loved when I saw that it was on their list. I'm like, oh, they're kind of appointment purchases, if you like. You're like, okay, I can eat ramen noodles for a week and just feed my kids the real meals and get myself this copy of this Blu-ray. So I just wanted to ask, like, was that a nice surprise, that coming up recently and all happening?
Absolutely. For me, I've been sort of out to sea on this movie for a while that I'm doing now. And, I miss physical media and these sort of releases and this is a UK release, so it's more in the foreign territory. So when I heard about it, I was very excited. And they sort of dug in and did some new interviews, and they reached out to a lot of the crew. And I was happy to be part of it. I had my copy is still sealed. I just got it, but I have not had a chance to actually sit and watch it. But I'm excited to take a look at it.
Well, if you see my letterbox, Jeremy, you'll see that I watched it twice in the last 2 days, and it's only because I had to watch the 4K, and then I saw you had a commentary. So I'm like, all right, well, I'll watch with Jeremy's commentary as well. So that is such a treat. That's really good. But I want to take it back, because this Macon Blair, I love this story, and I learned it later that it wasn't obvious that the star of Blue Room was going to be part of Green Room. In fact, the man himself had to go and put himself on tape and audition for this movie, despite being your best friend. And yes, also had an amazing story about having to ask a temporary tattooist to put sort of white power tattoos on him, but validate that it was for a rehearsal for a kind of a role in a movie. So I would love if you guys could tell us that story, because for me that sounds so deeply weird and funny, and the perfect way to start this conversation.
Yeah, I'm pretty severe when it comes to putting people sort of in the proper roles, and Blue Ruin was completely designed around Macon. And honestly, almost every film we had developed before that breakthrough was for Macon.
Yes.
So in my eyes, Macon is the movie star. And for Green Room, we also had financiers, and as that, the alchemy of trying to get the right cast that will get the movie funded was a big deal. Lots of people weighing in. And, me and Macon are always sort of, especially at that point, like joining at the hip and trying to develop things together. He's the first person that would read any draft of any script that I write. But for Green Room, there's a few roles in contention, and Macon, you probably remember it more clearly, but I was sort of entertaining lots of ideas and how you create certain chemistries between certain roles that need these dynamics. And, Macon is a certain way in my eyes. And again, always my protagonist. In fact, Green Room was for Macon, but it was
you aged out
10 years prior. So, because we had sort of waited to break through and all these ideas, we're always starting making. So the casting process was a joy and a blur, but I do remember Macon surprising me with the level of commitment in the self-tape, which included these tattoos. And, just to divorce ourselves from this friendship and make sure that whoever gets that role deserves it. And if it happens to be Macon, that it's just going to put him in the best possible light and showcase his skills. And I saw the tape, and it was really funny, because like he was full on in sort of neo-Nazi garb. I think you had a plaid shirt opened up. It's very clearly a chest tattoo and just little hints. And it was just neat because it took the pressure off our friendship, because he was my buddy, would find a place in the movie, but he was undeniably the best actor that we had auditioned for that role. And so he won it fair and square, and the tattoos certainly helped. But they didn't hurt. Megan, you told me that story about like the process of getting those was a little bit uneasy.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Your research is incredible, man. It's, I really had forgotten about that until now. But yeah, they were temporary tattoos, but they were custom. And so I was trying to get them made at this place, and I was bringing them all these, lightning bolts and 88s and just sort of like all this Nazi imagery. And the guy was like, no way, I won't do it. And I had to sort of give him material that, from previous movies, like assuring him that, I guess he thought it was going to reflect poorly on his business. Like, come here and I'll get your white power shit for you. And he didn't want to be part of that. So, so that part was fine. But really what it was I shot the audition elsewhere in Brooklyn from where I lived. So it was not getting the tattoos. It was applying the tattoos and then riding the train.
Oh God.
Right.
Not thinking, because I was like kind of like really wanted to do well on the, and I was like looking at my lines and stuff like that. And I kind of noticed like on the, I didn't think it through very well, but I was in costume on the subway and people were kind of looking at me. And it occurred to me that like, I'm going to have to explain to everybody on this train, just like the tattoo guy, this is just a movie. But I'm tiny, so it doesn't matter. But no, it was remarkable, and like, and I did totally like trust Jeremy's. He is like, he's got the vision for what his characters are, and so I thought the best I could do is just at least I'll do an audition and lose it fair and square, and go with that. And I was really not expecting to get it. It was right when I was moving out of New York, and I'd been there for a long time. I was Jeremy's neighbor. And the last night I was there, he was like, all right, green room's going ahead. It's going good. And I was like, yeah, cool. He was like, we're sending out our first casting offer tomorrow. And I was thinking like, oh, they found a Darcy, or, you know, they closed on Pat or something like that. I was like, oh no shit. Who's it for? He's like, for Gabe. It's for you.
Oh, that's so good.
Very cute. Yes, love that.
Yeah, it was great. So meant a lot. I was very excited.
So at the time that you were doing Gabe, because, you know, the gigantic Patrick Stewart, Sir Patrick, is Darcy. So at the time you were doing Gabe, you knew that you were gonna, did you have anything in your mind then at that time that like you're going to be working basically one-to-one as the conscience of the movie across from the devil himself in Darcy? Like, did you have, was that anything
remotely possible?
Yeah, no, I knew because of the part that Jeremy had written that whoever Darcy was going to be volcanic and terrifying.
Yes.
But mm-hmm. there was no Darcy until what, Jeremy, 2 weeks before?
2 weeks out, yeah.
2 weeks?
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so, tell that story, Jeremy. But it was another like confluence of events that ended up working out. But yeah,
it was just a ton of pressure. You know, that's the role that financiers sort of flock to, because it's, you know, an older white man. And that's kind of in the old school foreign sales sort of financing model. That's what does well, and yes, they always want that in their movie, and so. I don't usually adhere to that, but in this film, there clearly was that role. And I just wanted someone who could do it and was grounded, but finding that balance of someone who had the quote unquote market value that the financiers required to fully fund the movie, and the chops that I needed to photograph it, was a battle. And the funny thing is, we had, you know, the usual process is you start with like superstars and they turn you down, and, you know, who the hell is this guy, Jeremy Saulnier? Fuck no, I'm not doing a neo-Nazi part in this movie. And you go kind of down the rungs, and I won't name names, but then all of a sudden, it just, this coincidence where Patrick Stewart had a really good run and these iconic roles and had just joined the same management company that I was part of. And someone just said, well, how about this? And they just tossed him the script, and he was in the mood to switch gears, do something exciting for him and maybe his fans. And so all of a sudden, you know, our market value skyrocketed, and we had Sir Patrick Stewart. I remember what happened is we were already deep into prep in the stage, and we had a mosaic of all the actors sort of pinned to the flats.
Yeah.
And it had the entire cast in a big void in the middle where Darcy was supposed to be. And honestly, we were about to get shut down because we just needed to check that box. And then this sort of Patrick Stewart conversation evolved. I ended up sort of, you know, walking out of the stage and all the sort of the hammers and, the, you know, all the construction work being done. And I cried tears, man, because Patrick Stewart was on the phone with me, and he was like, I'm in. And I was like, are you joking? Like, is this actually happening?
Is this someone doing a really sick Patrick Stewart impression to me on the phone?
Yeah.
Macon, is this your best?
Is this Macon?
Yeah, exactly. Paranoia. This couldn't be true. And then he said yes. And I went down in there. I remember I had, you know, one of our PAs print out the headshot of Patrick Stewart and go into that mosaic of cast members and just boom, slapping him on the wall right in the center of the whole cast. And then immediately the crew, you know, they weren't fully in the know, but you can sort of, they can engage the undercurrent of dread and uncertainty about not having cast the heavy. So people started to congregate around me and just like see the picture of him. And it felt very cool to finally sort of complete the circle there. And then from then on, it was just like, you know, turbocharged, but it was really cool because I think Macon didn't have enough time to get too terrified. and it was neat. It was neat to see Macon, you know, right there with Patrick Stewart, and it was just two actors and they fed off each other and the chemistry was wonderful. And Patrick Stewart was very grateful to have such a great sort of, you know, cast member across from him through a lot of the scenes with him in it.
I felt like he went out of his way to kind of like put, I'm assuming everybody, but he certainly went out of his way to put me at ease because there was a lot of, our scenes were always together. So there was a lot of downtime with just sitting. And so I start out with the like, well, Sir Pat, can I get you? And he's like, just Patrick. And, you know, would very quickly just made it friendly and mellow. And I tried to sell him weed and, you know, we just.
Hopefully you gave him a discount.
Yeah, come on. Did anything about either character change with his casting, or was the script pretty much the script at that point?
It was a script, and the cool thing about Patrick was that he definitely did not want to inject anything. He didn't want to, you know, selling the vision. He wanted just to kind of, he wanted to play a role. He wanted to be Darcy. He wanted to do the research and put in the work and just be one of the ensemble cast. And there was one, and we usually stick close to the script. There's lots of, you know, a lot of minutiae in my movies that does pay off in some way, if not in a big sort of spectacular event, just some sort of structural sort of support that, okay, set up and pay off and all that. But there was one crucial moment where his character is searching the Ant Rights the band van. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things that are happening in mechanics. And he said, hey, Jeremy, if you don't mind, I want to add some dialogue. And I was like, oh, fuck, here we go. It's too good to be true. it's going to go off the rails here. And he said, at this particular moment, when I'm visible through the window, I'd like to add a fuck. And I was like, and just a single fuck? And he's like, yes. And I was like, absolutely. And it was funny how like it really, I think, sealed the whole scene up. It added this wonderful, like contemplative, deep moment. And it's also a rad curse word. So I was very happy to see that subtle touch alleviated my fears, but also like made the scene way better and deepened his character. So that was about it.
I was just gonna say, how many times do we get Patrick Stewart to say fuck? He was just like, I need to, just let me. Thank you.
It was this and Logan that allowed service. Him finally to say fuck.
That was it. Yeah, that was it.
He just took it. It was so subtle. Butter.
Macon, I think that's despite you being a star, I think you're like the best, and I say this with the greatest level of confidence. I think you're one of the best harmony that has ever been as an actor. Like I love watching you two together because his intensity doesn't work unless you're registering the intensity and trying to like, you're trying to talk the entire operation down off the ledge to a certain extent. And it does pay off in your characters in that kind of weird, kind of perverse, like, yeah, you've earned your stripes because of the way you tried to de-escalate this situation between the characters. But I just love that, you know, in some of your best performances, big and small, like even Logan Lucky, like you're being a harmony to Hilary Swank going ham in that movie. Like she's on one, which is awesome. Or like trying to be the harmony to Jason Clarke in like the scene of the year last year, right? Like going absolutely berserk and you're trying to wrangle. So here in that same intensity, you've got Darcy like talking this and this and that. And that just how I think that that's the, it's almost the subtle like torpedo of this movie is just how quickly and passively and organizationally carnage is just about to happen. It's like, okay, we're just going to clear the club and then we're going to get some dogs and you're going to shoot these people three times and not more than three, because you don't want to dig the slugs out, you know, more than, and it's just the madness of the reality of the carnage and how it's like you would be organizing a barbecue. Okay, can you just get some ice from down at the service station and you guys pick up some bread rolls? Yeah, just that interaction is just...
me too. When he was talking to Clark, what you're talking about right now, and they're bickering over how expensive it's going to be.
Yes.
Yeah.
Expecting some of their attack dogs to not make it out. And like, who's going to... It's like, who's putting in for beer? That kind of... I guess minutia, for lack of a better word, or getting lost in the weeds is something that Jeremy does really well. And he does it to greater and lesser degrees in other movies, certainly in Blue Ruin.
Yes.
Where, I mean, that whole movie is getting lost in minutia. Mm-hmm. But it also, that sort of felt like a natural fit for me. I'm assuming that's what Jeremy thought, because, you know, like me as one of the boots and braces guys who are doing the action, that wouldn't have felt right. But the guy who's kind of like, everybody settle down, please. that felt like I could slide into that. So
even so calmly, okay, you two are going to stab each other. And I'm going to answer you just so you, the way you, that is orchestrated. It's just like, this movie is madness. Sometimes you forget like the madness of the movie. And I think that that's the whole point of the quandary of your character, Gabe, which I love, is your empathy and your like humanity is the reason that the four core kids, and obviously Imogen Poots as Amber, that's why they stay in the room. And I remember... Yeah. Thinking that,
which is sinister, which is very sinister, because yes. of
very sinister. Yes, yes.
He's not there to help them.
No,
so.
Right. I almost hesitate to call it empathy.
Yes,
I think it's your face is incredibly likable. I think it's a very likable, very open.
And face. Yet,
and yet, and so I think I rewatched it literally. Today, like an hour before joining, got a Cinemax free trial for that. I mean, like when you're calming them down, obviously, because I've seen it before, I was like, fuck. Like, I remember the gut punch of realizing what he's doing with the 911 call and what he's going to do with the twins stabbing each other. And so I just think that's, you know, the register of that, I think, is very, very interesting. And I stepped on your question, Blake. I'm sorry.
No, no, it was just more that accessing that. And I think that that's probably more about Macon and Jeremy and why he said he's perfect for the part. It's just that accessing that thing of going, he is sort of projecting an empathy, but it is sinister. It's like balancing those two things of like, no, I'm just resolving a problem. That's fine. But the problem is that I don't want you to die right now.
I want you to die
in a very specific way elsewhere. I'm just starting the ball rolling on that. And it's so casual. And I think that probably the broader question is for Jeremy and Macon in being part of making this movie is like, is that the core tenet that you were sort of really penetrating and interrogating here? Is this like how quickly and passively and how kind of middle management-y sometimes really dark shit can be, because that's what I see. It's like these decisions that are just made, like you're making any decision can lead to death.
Absolutely. I mean, it's about, I think for Megan's character in particular, but for the whole film, like the nature of violence, the nature of evil, how it sort of ends up being a certain way, is a lot of people deny the truth for a short term to disown their part in it. And maybe, you know, Gabe is just trying to get through the next 14 minutes.
Yes.
And do this. And maybe he's buying time. Maybe he doesn't want this to end where it's going to end. And maybe that's why his character has so much depth. And I think I did remark at the end of production, like, oh shit, Megan, like, you're the only character in the movie with an arc. Yeah. Traditional arc. Because he's going through a lot and he's part of this thing. And I do, you know, I hate to overanalyze my own movies because they are.
That's for us to do.
I like, especially Roxanna. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Part of it is, oh shit, here's a cool idea. Here's a cool title. What would happen if this had, if this went down the other way? You know, punk rock sort of roots and having played shows and having been at venues and being scared and saying like, what the fuck? This is pre-cell phone in the mid-90s. Like, what would happen if this went south? Because we're young kids. We're 16, 17, around a lot of dangerous people at like a weird metal show in Manassas, Virginia. And all of a sudden, like, oh, there's some Nazi tattoos. Like, this is not quite like Washington, D.C. I'm a little scared here. And then you start to think, and that idea is just a simple premise. And then you inject, you know, what would I do? And you start to play both sides. But along the way, it becomes deeper, whether, you know, I intended it to be, or I'm, you know, adding sort of profundity when there's not really much there. But it is about, to your question, ideology and affiliation. And the general rule ended up being, whether as I was writing it or when I was releasing it and just talking some bullshit, but those who are able to shed their ideology and affiliation survive the movie.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so, and Gabe's the, sort of the one of the lone survivors of that side of the door, and kind of just realizes he's back in touch with his humanity and wants to go to jail.
I'll take jail, please. I do think, though, you know, like growing up on the Maryland side of the DC, Maryland, Virginia triangle of the worst traffic you've ever experienced in your life, I do think it is really fascinating how quickly you can be at a punk show or you can be in a part of Virginia where you're like, everything's fine. And then suddenly you're like, shit feels really ominous, actually. Mm-hmm. Like the border between those two feelings is like very thin. And I guess what I want to ask is like the Nazi punks fuck off scene, I think captures that quickness, right? Like how quickly things can change. And I guess I'm just wondering like everything about that scene, like when that was the song that you guys decided, what it was like to film that, all the sort of details of that turning point.
Yeah, it's just sort of, you know, there's a weird camaraderie. So I remember being at shows in the 90s and there would be, you know, kids wearing the Letterman jackets. There was like emo kids. There was Christian Accor. There was just regular like crusty punk people.
Straight edge kids, yeah, who found their way in. Yeah, yeah.
Sharp representatives, skinheads against racial prejudice. And then there were Nazi skinheads. And there was some fighting. I think I was only witness to one stabbing. But it was, you know, DC in the 90s was not safe. But there was some weird thing about neutral ground.
Mm.
And it didn't always end up in violence, but there was tension, but the music is what brought people together. And so maybe there was a little truce or something, but I just wanted to not get too ideological. It's like the scene with Nazi punks fuck off is the ant-rights fucking with their audience, which happens a lot. And it's it's probably what made, you know, Worm and the audience respect him. I mean, he spit some shit at him, some beer, but he was, that's what gives them respect, is a fuck you and a fuck you back. And that sort of macho back and forth. And then it evolves to, despite that, then they kick into the music, the next song. And then there's just sort of serene moment of just fusion and physicality, and everything drops away and it felt beautiful. And that's, I think, the only time I've ever used slow motion in any movie I've done.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt right. And we storyboarded it, and we picked it off, and it felt really good. And that was about, like, you know, one, seeing the Eight Rights on stage, having a fun sort of punk rock fuck you, and then transitioning to sort of that one moment of beauty before everything goes to shit. It felt right thematically. It felt right musically and visually. So, yeah, very proud of that scene and what it represents. And I think a lot of people, you know, I wasn't a big touring guy. I was, you know, I was sort of like a pat. I felt more like an imposter. I was a yeller in a hardcore band, and my really talented musician friends, they had multiple bands. They would go on tour. A lot of the detailed stories from life on the road was just, you know, interviewing my high school buddies. And it was just infusing that with some sort of, but people respond to that who are in bands, who know the scene in a certain way. And, you know, some people turn down the script on a true level because they had been too close to that. They had been on the scene. Some of their friends have gotten hurt, you know, really badly, whether it be Delaware or Oregon. You know, it was a real thing. And one of the things was that we made the film, one of the foreign distributors I showed it to was like, is this some kind of period piece? Is this like an 80s movie? And it didn't quite see the coming relevance of it all. But
Right. Well, thank you for sharing that. I mean, that scene so perfectly then, as you said, sets up Worm being like, your band is really good, which is such a fucked up, hilarious moment.
It's so funny. What was that track? And you're like, and Anton Yelchin just giving the best reaction, bewilderment and fear.
Yes.
And also then like doing the Rolodex in his head. Oh, that was this track.
Yeah. And that's a track, Coronary, from my good buddies that my bandmates. I had another band. And that was a song that I remember from my youth. And that was the one that got everyone going. It had a crazy rad mosh part, slowing it down. And no matter what they did, that the pit always erupted. And it's funny you mentioned that scene. It's a perfect scene. We had to ship in our good friend Brent Wurzner because, you know, local casting was going well, but Firm has not a big page count, but he is the whole fucking movie. The whole thing switches on him and his sort of sinister nature, and he has to have a presence that is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Brent was on Blue Ruin, but we had to secretly fly, you know, it had to be local casting that we had to buy the financiers. We flew his ass ourselves. I think our producers were cool to kind of sneak him in there. And he played Worm. And when he came in that scene and just looked down at Anton, we kept it in the mix, but on Anton's lavalier mic, his fucking heart is beating out of his chest. And it's part of the soundtrack. It's his actual heart. And
I love that.
Terrified. Oh, it was wonderful. So the chemistry
that's,
there was.
That's a great trick. That's a great trick because it's like you sometimes, you can sneak that into the mix, but sometimes you think your own heart is beating when you're watching it. You're like, is that me? Is that my heart that I can hear beating? And the answer most often, especially in Blue Ruin and then in Green Room, is yes, that is my heart beating. That's me that's me adding to the sound mix on my couch right now as I'm watching this or in the cinema seat when I'm watching it.
A funny just trivia connection there, but the song that Jeremy was talking about that he took from a band that we knew, the singer for that band was the guy that got killed in the bathroom in Blue Ruin, the guy that got stabbed in the head. That's
fun.
15 years ago was the singer for that band. So
that's great.
That is
look
great.
At this collective filmmaking via friendship.
Yeah,
that's fun.
Yeah. Let's talk about the kids. And I say kids because they just feel like the kids of this movie. Elisha Shawkat, Anton, Imogen, Callum Turner, Joe Cole. Like, I forgot how much I love those guys in this movie. So can you talk about their connection? Because they're awesome. I feel like everyone who was in a band in high school in the 90s, myself included, was crying out for a female bass player. We were just screaming for it, but there was just, they were a commodity that was extremely hard to come by, whatever kind of punk rock we were all trying to do. But I love their entire weird and wonderful chemistry. And I particularly love Joe Cole, who plays Reese's arc of, like, in the movie, of being just completely backgrounded and then watching him take, like, band leadership role as this situation gets extremely hairy. So I'd love if you could talk about finding that crew of actors that have to, you know, hold so much of the movie for a long time.
It was funny. I mean, we were certainly blessed on this production, you know, with casting. A.B. Kaufman came on board, and there was pressure to get famous heads in there. At that age range, you're not getting a ton of movie stars.
Yes.
And I think I've noticed, I don't check the social media much, but I noticed a post recently about how disrespectful it is to have actors self-tape. And I think at a certain point, that's true. And it's up to the actor. But that's how we found every motherfucker in this movie. And the mandate was, hey, I need real people. I want this to be grounded. This is based on people I know. They don't need to match that physicality 100%, but they need to be like my friends growing up. And at the time, U.S. agencies were really just trying to breed sort of the next Spider-Man, or they're feeding sort of like either really sort of handsome waifs or beefcake guys or whatever it was. They had a veneer on them that I just didn't feel was right for this movie. And like a lot, you know, like a lot of filmmakers, like, we need someone who's truly salt of the earth American, like, go to Australia. And for us, it was the UK. And so, and Macon is sort of like, you know, we were just like co-pilots. Like, Macon was watching all the auditions, and, you know, we were going through all the stuff, and I need help, because honestly, there was a lot of cool choices, and we would sort of confer. But I remember the self-tape that Callum Turner gave us. I remember the self-tape Joe Cole gave us. I remember, you know, they're authentic. They went above and beyond to record themselves. They were perfect, and sort of, they were instant choices. It's hard to find. Joe Cole he's a real motherfucker. He's actually super strong and has that physicality, but doesn't look like sort of a, you know, Adonis, like, gym rat dude.
Yeah.
He doesn't look like the American version of that guy.
Yeah.
He looks like the British version of that guy who was in, like, the Thai MMA movie, because he was. Like, he actually looks like someone who could kick your ass.
I think in America and Oz, we call it like I've heard the phrase farm strong. Like, you've just got mates who are just like, they don't look like much, but if you need to move something, like, I've got a couple of buddies, like, real skinny, you need to move a fridge, you get that guy, and you're like, what? How can you lift this? Like, there's three other guys on the side, on one side, and there's one guy on that side just with one hand going, yeah, I got it. And you're like, that's Joe. Mm-hmm. That's Joe Cole in this movie. It's like, yeah, that's your buddy who.
And, you know, and I write what I know, and what I know is a bunch of dudes. And so, Green Room is all dudes. That's the band of all dudes. And I kept trying to find Sam.
Yeah.
The dude. And after a while, like, it's about energy. It's just about chemistry. And I was like, I don't know, guys. Like, I'm not finding Sam. And Anish and Neil, our producers, had worked with Alia Shawkat on a Kelly Reichardt movie recently, like threw out a few ideas, and then Alia Shawkat self-taped as Sam, and it wasn't a choice. Like, let's look at, I said, let's open it up to whoever. And she just sent a tape in during prep, and I was like, there's Sam. Like, she just has it.
Yeah.
A good lesson for me too. Like, oh yeah. Shit. Like, you know, this band to me was because Sam was based on Sam.
Yeah.
My buddy. It's a dude. Mm-hmm. Her energy was more like Sam. She, you know, having to corral a bunch of knuckleheads and having sort of a more managerial sort of presence within the group. And that was really fun. She again self-taped, came in, and I had my choice, and I like the self-tape personally because I see how they interpret my material without any direction. Mm. And that's the easiest choice. When they nail it, that's it.
Yeah.
And it saves, that pays off also throughout the whole production because they're self-governing their characters because they, you know, like they got it from day one, and then you can nudge in one way or say, actually this scene, you know, for like story comprehension, like this line is going to come back later, so just do this to it or bury this or whatever it is. It's all just like you're a mixer.
Yeah.
Take it down and you don't have to explain anything. You just let them rip and it's awesome. And you're an audience member and you get excited because they make your material better than it was on the page. And that's all you're looking for every time.
Yeah. My, I love, there's two things that I want to tag on there is that with it, both sort of Tarantino adjacent. One of them was like, he said that Harvey Keitel actually, who's now 85 this year, holy shit, happy birthday in advance to Harvey Keitel, gave him a great note when they first worked together on Reservoir Dogs saying, Quentin, don't give an actor any notes when they're rehearsing for a part in your movie when they first rehearse. Because he said the adjustment is exactly as you said, the adjustment's the easiest thing. But that first time where you see how they interpret the material is the most invaluable reading of that because they might take it somewhere. Like you said, with the energy of Alia, like the energy that she brought to Sam is the energy you wanted, but it was absolutely not like what you're expecting. So it's that energy of the tape. And my other favorite one is Josh Brolin was filming one half of Grindhouse when he went on tape for No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
And he sent it to the Coen brothers. And the Coen brothers contacted Josh Rosenblatt and asked who lit his scene. And it was Robert Rodriguez. They just wanted
to
know.
That's hilarious.
They said who lit this self-tape because it looked a little bit different to some of the other self-tapes that had come into the. Who the fuck lit this self-tape? I must know. It's like, oh, it's actually Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino's directing me do this side. So yeah, they were interested.
I mean, that does feel like cheating.
That is 100%
different. That's
100% cheating. You know? And when Macon's next three self-tapes, both all three directed by Christopher Nolan, go out for his next three performances. That is also cheating. But you know what? I'm here for it. I'm here for the cheating.
Yeah. And what else is Nolan doing? Like honestly.
Come on.
Give some time back, you know?
Yeah.
I also think that the Alia casting is so good because then it adds that friction with her and Imogen Poots.
Yes.
Which is such, like, I hate to say it's like such a feminine friction, but it is. Like, these two women just don't like each other immediately. And, like, I've been in that situation where it's just like you're used to being the one woman in a group of men. And it's like, who the fuck are you? So I think that's also really fun. And yeah, I'm wondering if you had to, again, did you have to tweak that or like how did things change, if at all, by casting her?
I think, well, and we also, like, we let that, like, you know, my bias towards an all-male cast, we let that carry over to Patrick Stewart. So there's a line when he's like, gentlemen.
Yeah, he only says gentlemen. Yeah.
We didn't, because he's assuming. He hasn't really seen them, doesn't care the fuck they are. He's assuming that's what it is. And I said, you know what? We could change that to like gentleman and lady, but that would sound really lame. So let's just let his sort of incorrect assumption carry through. Cause that's what would happen when you're blind to what's going on. enforced. Mm-hmm. But no, with the whole cast, you know, we had, there was some, I wouldn't call it tension, but it was like the Aintrights flew to Oregon and they formed a real band. Because Anthony had experience, but you know, Joe Cole had to learn drums in 2 weeks and did a pretty good job at faking it.
From they played the rap party.
Yeah, they played. So ended up
they played the rap party. That's so good. I hope they open with Nazi Punk's "Fuck Off."
Well, they played songs from the movie, and then they ended their set with an original song they had written. Yeah.
Oh wow. Okay, that's good.
But you know. So good. I think there was some, I think, you know, it's like between Alia and Imogen, like they kind of knew the deal, and there was a fun amount of chemistry or tension between them. It wasn't necessarily, you know, off camera, but it was fun because it got tough in there. Putting all of those actors through the ringer, and it's just like, you know, you're always live because you're in a box and the camera's covering over the shoulders and mediums and this and that, but like you can't escape it. You're always having to be there either on camera or really feeding back to the actor who is. And it didn't really get tense, but it got
heavy
and exhausting and very physical. But you know, after I think 3/4 of the way through the film, because you know, Emmy and Anton were buddies, so they did Friday Night together and were homies, so it was cool. And then you know, after the film and as it was wrapping up, I know the entire cast was very close, including Emmy, because she was designed, you know, in the film itself, she doesn't get a close up until a certain point. She's kind of disregarded and she is pushed out of that inner circle until, you know, a pivotal moment where she, I think her affiliation switches. And that then she has to earn her way into a medium. And then finally, you know, she gets media close-ups as her and Pat, you know, kind of ally to get through the rest of the movie. But to your point, like it was natural and it was there and I just didn't interfere.
Mm-hmm.
Just try to be as humane as possible. And then sometimes be sort of a shithead. And it's like, oops, we've baked into continuity like fire extinguisher retirement and dust and smoke. And it was tough to put them through that. It was bad.
So for everyone watching it, what I think is so crazy, and I want to get back to the box of the room and the club and the inner workings. But Jeremy, could you share with Rox and I, like the exterior stuff, the cornfields and all that other stuff, and then just the outside, that is all shot on location so fast. Like, I think it was like, in my research and in your commentary, I think you referenced a couple of days, I think is the exact phrase that you use here in my notes. It's a couple of days to nail the exteriors that are shot, that basically make up and stitch together the entire movie. And then your inner set, obviously a more controlled environment to do all of the inner workings of the club and everything like that. But can you talk, you elaborated a little bit on your commentary, but I'd love to sort of talk to you a bit more about it with Rox here and Rox tag on anything that you're really interested in. I want to know about what that's like with the pressure of executing on location in limited time. And then obviously then coming back to, we are just going to all be here in this absolutely chaotic environment. And like, I think about it from a sound perspective, like the reverberance, the chaos of like people just feeling it. And you know, you see actors when they've got to do heightened emotional scenes, like we'll run laps around a set and lose their breath and do all that, and just imagining all the practical, like I am physically ready for this scene. Like I imagine, especially because it's in a box that has a hole in it into a dungeon, it's like it must have been crazy.
It was, and you know, it, in many respects, you know, because coming from Blue Ruin, you know, I shot that myself as the DP, and was incorporating almost like corporate video tactics, like stuff I learned shooting for IBM documentaries, whatever. Like you could do a lot with a sort of a digital SLR with video capabilities and a 5-foot slider and all these things. So I was used to like Blue Ruin. We had 30 days, which was a relative luxury, but we scaled production down and then back up. So it was very affordable. When we were doing the first part of Blue Ruin, it was like 10 person crew, then it was 16, then we bumped up to 24 and then 28 for a night exterior. So we had all this control and governance over our own movie, and just did it the smart way, the efficient way. Scenes were written to be compartmentalized. We had Macon the whole time, and then we'd have a guest actor come in and nail it for 2 days and then fly back to where they had, so they weren't committing this time. Now, this is what they tell people. It's like, do people talk in a room for a movie? But that's much harder. So Blue Ruin was like out in the open. We shot in 3 states, but it was so downscaled that it was easier, and we could float around. When you get people in a room, you need all those people in the room for the duration of the project. You also need continuity. So weather was a big issue. So it was actually I think 9 days. It was 2 weeks of shooting for the opening. But it included, because of, you know, Patrick Stewart was our heavy, and, you know, we wanted to respect his time. So we shot him out soon.
Yes.
Which means for me, we had to start with the finale.
Yeah.
And with such carefully controlled continuity of it, it takes place in about, you know, a 30-hour span. So you're like, holy shit, we have to decide what happened to everybody. We haven't shot it yet. And it's our best guess. And then kind of end on this really important note and establish our characters on day one and not have time to kind of feel them out, develop an arc, talk about it. It's just like, here we go. But luckily the weather in Oregon was really great for us because it was overcast. So we shot in a sort of extended dawn sequence for about 3 or 4 days.
Right.
In the finale, and Patrick and I were just talking, and I was going to make it like, yeah, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing here. It's crazy. Because in Blue Ruin, we designed the entire first part of the schedule around Macon's beard.
There's no better reason to design any movie, in my opinion, than Macon's beard. Design it all around it.
I should
A lot of people say that.
But there was, you know, we had enough time to prep and think about it. So the overall design of the exteriors was to keep it airy, to keep it floaty, to keep it moving. You know, it was a lot of sort of Broody and Dolly work in the finale, but after the finale scene at the sort of the compound, we went in and shot all the stuff with the Aintrights cruising around the coast and playing a show, and then we went to the exterior venue. And that's where the concept was inside the room. It is just really simple blocking. It is not a lot of camera moves, but outside it's like sharks circling. It's always swirling. Macon and Kai, you know, as Gabe and Clark, they're always moving, always walking and talking. And it's this swirling sensation just to offset inside and out. And we had intended to shoot, I'm a very sort of practically minded person, and I like location shooting. It gives me sort of ceilings and limits, and I'm inspired by window light and these things that are real. But shortly after, we had exhausted our attempts to find a location that worked. So we had to pull the trigger and say, we're just gonna build it. We have to build the venue. And I didn't know how important that was. I mean, it saved the movie because I had pre-blocked the entire film in my head. I knew where every doorway was, hallway, adjacent thing, the bars here. So by being able to design the set, there was no translation from script to screen as far as what I had envisioned.
Yeah.
That was very helpful. But so we did 2 weeks of just like running around, like getting on a condor to shoot a cornfield, and, you know, holy shit, it was just running around in the mud and the rain. And then we got into the soundstage, and it was so different. Like, we could control the weather. You could sit there and sort of, you know, cook in your own broth. Like, oh shit! Like, you get tired. There is no light, so the circadian rhythms are out the window, and it's exhausting. And the energy you know, there is no fresh air. There is no swirling movie. You're just trapped and it's crying and yelling and consternation and just like trying to figure shit out. And it's like that energy was like, it was hard to shake it. And one of the fuck ups on the movie is I actually told Anton, like, stop fucking crying, dude. Like, you know, I can't take it anymore. I was getting, I was like, you're going to calm down here and deliver it this way. And I took him too far and had to make some snips in the edit to transition. But another lesson is like, trust the actors with their own continuity. When you're, you know, I was terrified. I don't want my guy to always be crying, but he was just staying in that moment. And it's just like a short window of his performance. But it got really hectic. The blocking, you know, the stunts, all that, you know, everyone's great. Everyone's game. It was so hard to get like cables, and we wanted them to take weight off people when there's wrestling. And, you know, when Big Justin gets sort of mounted from behind and there's like jujitsu happening. And, you know, Eric was just like, fuck it. Like, take the wires off. I'll just do it. You know? And it was so hard to do it the right way, but I always defer to the actors, but when they're game, that's what, you know, me and Macon come from that school of like, we've done some dangerous filmmaking. You know, Megan's been set on fire many times, been thrown into a lake, and we got hit by cars, we've blown up fireworks on our chests. So you don't want to assume anyone else is down for that. And it's not legal or proper, but you know, we do appreciate those who are not afraid to get a little fucked up for the art.
I love the idea of handing out a questionnaire that's like, Macon's done these things. Where are you guys gonna rate?
Where are you on the Macon scale? Are you fireworks?
Yeah, no, nobody comes close.
No.
Although for Blue Ruin, Macon, you can attest. Did we break you on Blue Ruin?
No.
Okay, because you had a remember your ankle injury?
I got dinged up a little bit, but it was I was too busy like this it I don't know, I just was having such a good time, and it just felt like, I mean, Murder Party was a real movie too, but this felt like a level up into like a real movie, and like I don't know, I felt like we were adults for the first time or something. Yeah. So I was delighted. I would have broken both ankles.
Sweet.
The way Jeremy asked that, I was like, physical, emotional, both? Like, what are we?
You broke us. You broke us when we watched it. We were like, our heart breaks with this guy. He's the best.
Oh, I'm just noticing your shirt now too, Rex.
I was like, you know what? I am going to be the guy who wears the band t-shirt to see the band. I am going to do that. I have the
long version of that.
I also have that.
Very cool. Very cool.
Sometimes I ask Roxana to buy two of the things she's buying. I just text her and I, can you buy two? And I'll email, give you money and figure it out later. But I did notice that Macon is wearing, and this is just before you jumped on, he's wearing a Sorcerer t-shirt right now. He's wearing
That's pretty tight.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I saw it straight away.
That's pretty good. Yeah. That's pretty good.
That's really good. I'm just trying to think if there's much more that I wanted to cover other than to say, man, if this was our normal decade project, we'd talk about like where these actors and characters have gone, and Macon, you being one of them, like I think only everyone in this cast has gone off to do other incredible and amazing stuff. And the one tragic note is that your great leading man is no longer with us. And I think that he's a guy that monumental is a word I'd probably say. He was just always so fantastic and just brimmed with this kind of potency and potential, and it's just the devastation of this is that he's one of our two survivors of this movie, spoilers, and has a great moment with his friend. It's so nice to hear that him and Imogen were friends, because it makes the I Now Have My Desert Island Disc song, and she's like, fuck, I don't care, or whatever she says is the best line of the movie.
Tell to someone who fucking cares.
The best line of the movie. But God, he sounds like he was amazing. Can you tell us anything about working both of you with Anton as an actor? Because I think it's so special, and I cherish this movie so much, because I feel like it is truly one of his best performances. It's one of the best things he ever produced.
Yeah. Sorry. Megan, take it away.
Shit.
Woo. He was the best. He was like, oh, I always do this, man. And Meg, I actually want to know, has anyone seen the Second Sight interview about, you know, the updated interview for Green Room? Because I fucking weep like a child on that thing. And
I hope
it's not too embarrassing.
Like has, yeah.
It's not too embarrassing. It's beautiful. Because, you know, like for folks who just have like a regular job, if you hear about someone who passed away at a previous gig and you were close with them for a time, like that hurt, that really hurts. And so like in the film industry, I think people detach themselves because it's personalities and egos and actors, and people think, oh, like, do they have an organic connection, or do they still resonate? Do they hold a place? Do they have a relationship? Like there's a lot of stuff that's unknown unless you're a filmmaker, or people like, you know, Rox and I who dig into it or speak to filmmakers constantly and are a little bit more aware, but people don't realize the connections that you make. And so the thing that kind of destroyed me watching that Second Sight thing and listening to your commentary again is just hearing like how deep the connections are on these things and how special they are to you. And Jeremy, you haven't made 400 films yet. And we're very happy with the films that you have made. So to hear that the connections on each of these makes us so important to you in the long term, you know, you guys are circus folk. And so when you find each other, it's so nice to hear that you make an impact, because, you know, you might only get lucky enough to work with an Anton, even if he was alive and well to this day, you might only get lucky enough to work on it with it once. And then you see him at an award show in 10 years and you go, holy shit, it's my guy, you know, like, so that's for me, it's nice. It's only comforting.
And you know, we actually went through that phase with the character of Pat. You know, we had some other offers out. It's funny, when I told Anton after the fact, he's like, you outright to who? I was like, bro, no. And he had sort of a receding hairline. And I was like, I don't know, maybe he's too old for Pat. I don't know. And Macon was like, no, he's really got chops. Because I actually don't track actors. I'm just like, back then, I just, you know, had no need to. I didn't know if I was going to make movies for a living. So when Anton... this is the big deal too, is that Anton reached out to our team.
Wow.
He got his hands on Green Room and wanted to play it. And I hesitated. And then I had back then, was it Zoom or Skype? I don't know. But I had a video conference with him. And like, again, he reminded me of Macon, that like he was sweet. He was perfect. And he seemed like a really good human. He was insanely smart, and I just kind of knew after hearing his voice that he was Pat. Oh shit! Like that's it. I can't even think of anyone else now. And then, you know, and it's not just sort of after the fact justifying what went down, but yeah, he's the only Pat, and it was great because his interest and enthusiasm that is infectious. So when he came to me for the role, you know, I was a huge fan of the Fright Night remake with him and Imogen. It was very fun.
Great movie.
Maybe a little too CG with the vampires, but it was a proper, as they call it, reimagining. Okay, it wasn't the same thing. It was different. They moved venues, moved hosts. It was great. But I was worried about Imogen and him reuniting on my movie, like, oh, we've been there and done that. But again, I was like, well, fuck it. The chemistry is right. And they were sort of like the big dog actors in that ensemble. But on set, you know, Anton was just bugging the shit out of me. He would like text me all this stuff about Pat and infuse all his real life. I was like, dude, you're good, man. Like that level of investment was fantastic. He always cared. He always had something to bring. And so I did just help him through scenes, except for that one where I fucking told him to stop crying and messed up that scene. But other than that, you know, he hit perfect notes.
I don't think I'm even tracking what you're talking about there, Rox. Is that fair to say? So that he messed up a scene?
I respect his ability to have his own opinions. Like, that's, you know, let's let Jeremy have that. Well, that's fine. Sure.
It's something I realized in the edit and had to find a way to stitch it together, because the continuity that he had would have been perfect. And I had to do some stuff with Julia, our editor, kind of to bridge that gap. Because I wasn't aware of the immediacy of the continuity, just because I was getting so affected. I hated watching him go through that. Yeah. And he did it for the movie. And he had some issues breathing, and he had, you know, all this dust and shit in the air, and he was very quiet about it and humble about it and kind of got through it. And only after we really wrapped did he tell me, like, that was pretty tough on it. And I was like, come on, man, you got to tell me these things. But he was so sweet and so invested. And I knew him for a short while, but it was formative. And so I was like, this is my first professional movie. And part of that, when I was talking about Blue Ruin and moving fast, was like, Green Room was so slow. It was a big, properly paid union crew with trucks and gear. And to offload the truck in Green Room, we would have wrapped, you know, four or five setups in Blue Ruin. And then if we had to go overtime in Blue Ruin, we just sent people home, and I would have soft serve ice cream and just shoot some B-roll on the beach by myself in Delaware. And it's good. But here's like the rules, the constraints. And I actually make into it can attest to this. Like, I was going to bug the fuck out and leave that production, quit day three. And we were at shooting the Mexican restaurant scene. And I was like, this is fucking awful. I don't know how to do this. This is so slow. And this is no sort of disparaging remark about the crew. I had just no concept of what it took and didn't know that, you know, Blue Ruin cost us about $185,000 cash for $425 all in. And we did 30 days and had a sort of, I guess, relatively luxurious schedule as far as time. And for Green Room, we had a $5 million budget and had one less day to shoot it and a lot more ground to cover as far as the continuity and stuff. So the effects work and all that. So it was sort of insane. But Anton was a big part of that, grounding the production. And he was the leader of the cast, although he was just the bassist in the Ain't Rights. But it fused everything together, and, you know, it wasn't until I think mid shoot that Macon Blair had a spaghetti party at his apartment where I was finally aware, because I was like fight or flight the whole time. Like the financiers and myself were not in a good position. I just didn't understand, like, being wooed by a company and then having all these weird notes come in, trying to turn Green Room into Die Hard and all these crazy things. It just, like, I wasn't used to, but we were all at Macon's house, and I just remember, like, shooting slow motion iPhone video of, like, everyone jumping around to the Misfits and eating spaghetti. And, like, I was like, oh, no. Filmmaking is fun. I forgot that. And it was fun. But him and all the cast, like, you know, and I'm not good at keeping in touch with people. So as far as the 10 years, when that does come around, you know, maybe I'll use that as I got to touch base with everybody, because I, you know, as a director, sometimes with the family and obligations, like, you had your head all the way up your own ass for years at a time. And but I will say, like, what we were able to achieve, you know, because, you know, me and Macon we always develop stuff together, and again, he's informing every decision I make, whether it be casting or music. You know, we put together something cool and very special, and with Anton's passing especially. And I don't want to disparage his other movies, but I know we were one of two movies that he was head over heels in love with. So it means a lot.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Jeremy.
Thank you so much. And I think that next year, I mean, flights are expensive, but for making Blair's spaghetti and some slow motion video dancing, Now I might have to get that passport sorted out, Rox.
Once again, I'm saying, are we not doing a Christopher Nolan hosted spaghetti party green room reunion? Like, these ideas are gold. A24, call us. Yeah, what's the problem? Macon, is there anything you wanted to say about Anton? I don't want to push you if it is too close.
Jeremy summed it all up perfectly. I think one of y'all earlier in this conversation referred to it as a circus, and that's one of the things that I really am grateful for and treasure about getting to work on movies, is that instant intimacy where you just meet somebody, and because you have to yell at them or be in love with them or whatever it is that you have to do it so immediately and with no barriers. And so because of that, you, at least in my experience, you tend to get very close with people very quickly. And maybe you don't, maybe it's only, you know, like they say in the movie, maybe it's only for that duration. But in this case, everybody did get really close, and Anton was a huge part of that. And I still have videos on my phone that I watch of just us while Jeremy's over here setting up a shot, getting ready to go. And we get a little bit of fart around time and just sort of like playing and joking or whatever. And it's very special, and it's something to be treasured. And yeah, something I'm very grateful for.
The thing that I like to think about every time after finishing this movie is, what would his answer have been? And like, there are movies that don't leave you with sort of like fun, introspective questions to consider. So among like all of the many things that this film does well, I think denying us that answer, but how well Anton delivers that line of like, we've survived this and I've figured it out. You know, like that ending in and of itself, I think is just a little mini masterpiece of a thing. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for it.
Yeah. We treasure these conversations with you guys. And thank you so much for sharing this movie. I mean, it's not the funnest hang to be. If I could just say one thing, but it is a credit to you guys both as director, producer, actor, writers together collectively, you know, friendship. It's a testament that it's so rewatchable, that you want to go back and visit it. You want to see the purity and the clarity of these characters going through this hellish thing together, and you want to face the emotional quandaries that you take us through. And I just want to say that genuinely, this is, I said it sort of facetiously at the beginning of our chat, but like, I genuinely have treasured these conversations. They're just so special to me, and I just want to thank you so much. And again, we come back and know that Rebel Ridge is on its way, Jeremy. So we're very excited. And thank you for taking time out of finishing touches on that bad boy to talk to us again. And Macon, thank you for being our coordinator and making this happen and being the sole lobbying voice for How and Wygand, the insider podcast that has not yet been created. So I just want to say, I'm feeling very grateful and feeling very grateful for you both for being so open and candid and sharing and feeling grateful that we're here together. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you guys. Macon, thank you for being our conciliary every time.
Always. The best. That is him, isn't it? Isn't it? Can we get you a conciliary Tom Hagen kind of role? That's good. That's good stuff. Macon as Tom Hagen. I like that. Rox, you nailed it.
Well, I'm pissed because he has his own mafioso team now, and you know, up to his own stuff. He has his own family he's got to look after. But I really appreciate you guys and your continued interest, because you know, Macon and I, we have a lot going on, but it's a nice reminder of what we did and what we're doing, and that some people still give a shit.
Oh,
thank you very much. It's very cool. If we're still doing goofy titles, then this would be the first step. But you call it Green Room Tone, I think, would be the podcast.
Green Room Tone.
Excellent work.
Yeah.
Excellent work.
Yeah.
That's it. There you go.
There you go.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.